All right, we are in Mark chapter 1. We finished up looking at the demon-possessed man in the synagogue last week. And now we're going to look at something a little more personal in chapter 1, verses 29. And hopefully we'll get to 39. We'll finish those 10 verses today. All right, so we note that he was at the synagogue, and the synagogue, this is an overview of Capernaum up on the PowerPoint right now. Capernaum is right about here. I know it's difficult to see with the lighting and everything, but right here is where the synagogue is meant to be. This is the ruins of a 4th century synagogue, so it's a little bit after the synagogue that Jesus was in, but it's still the location. The ruins of this particular synagogue were built on top of the synagogue that had been built at the time of Jesus in the 1st century. So that's the location. The believed location of Peter's house is right there. So you see how close those things are. And I'll show some pictures later on just to show exactly how close they are. But we see in this particular passage, could you turn on the light again, please? I'm going to read a little bit. Thank you. we're going to look at Mark chapter 1. Verses 29 through 31, so right now. So if someone could read that, that would be great.
Now as soon as they had come out of the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon and Andrew, from James and John. But Simon's wife, mother, lay sick with a fever, and they told him about her at once. So he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and immediately the fever left her, and she served them.
All right. So we see that that there's a lot of people here in this particular house. We see that this is the house of Simon and Andrew. Of course, we understand Simon to be Peter. And so Simon and Andrew, this is their house here in Capernaum. And again, it's believed to be Capernaum. We'll discuss exactly the location in a little bit. But I want to overview this for a moment. Then we see also the people who live in this particular house are presumably Simon's wife and Simon's mother-in-law. All right? So this tells us that Peter is married. And does he stay married as far as we know? Yeah. When we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 5, do you remember the context of that? What Paul is talking about there? Why don't we turn there? Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 5. And whoever's got that, please read.
Do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do also the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord, and Cephas?
All right. So this is the context that Paul is saying that he is, apparently this is the passage where it's revealed to us that he is a single man. He is not married. Barnabas also is a single man, but it shows that the rest of the apostles are married. And that includes Peter. He says Cephas in that, calls him Cephas. And Cephas is the Aramaic term for a stone, which is translated in Greek, Petros, which is Peter, right? So Peter is married, and he stays married, all right? So, you know, if he were... He does not... So as we understand in Catholic understanding of things, that since the Catholic clergy are not allowed to marry or take a vow of celibacy, we note that Peter, if he were the first pope, would not be able to because He was a married man. Now, I do see some logic behind why they would want to keep their clergy unmarried based on some things that are said in the Bible. But at the same time, there's some give and take. There's some advantages and disadvantages to being married or unmarried. So, yes.
Not to mention, of course, there's no notion of clergy in the New Testament. And there's also a place where Paul says there's going to be false teaching, and one of the things they're going to do is forbid to marry.
Forbidding to marry. That's right. That's right. So, we are... Yes?
I just want to share what I was taught when I was being brought up in the Catholic Church. A married priest would be less likely to run into a burning house to save someone.
I know some married firemen. Does that? but see, 1 Corinthians 7 talks about that a little bit. It says that if a man is married and his concern is with pleasing his wife, and while that's true, my concern is with pleasing my wife, I still have a concern with pleasing the Lord and serving the Lord. So you can chew bubblegum and walk at the same time.
Some of us can.
Some of us can. Yeah. All right. So that is, and especially it depends on the wife too. There are some preachers who are married who they don't stay preachers for very long because their wife isn't very supportive. And so you do need a wife that's very supportive, and I'm grateful for mine. All right, so we do not know if Andrew were married or if there are any children or other in-laws or parents living in this particular house. Whatever the case, it is very likely that Simon and his wife were fulfilling the commands to honor your father and mother. Right? That's one of the Ten Commandments, right? And that's exactly what Simon is doing here by taking care of his mother-in-law. This shows Simon to be a righteous man, doesn't it? Isn't it a good thing to take care of your parents and your in-laws? I'm sure you would love for, some of you would love your kids or kids-in-law to take care of you if that need should arise. That is a good thing. That is a righteous thing for Simon to do. They come immediately after worship, perhaps around lunchtime. I mean, I'm assuming that's how we do things. Around lunchtime to his house, and including other disciples that Jesus had called by then, James and John. So we see in this house that Peter's family is obviously here. Simon's mother-in-law probably didn't make it to worship that morning because she was sick. And then we see that after they leave, Simon and Andrew, along with Jesus, James, and John, go to Simon and Andrew's house. And then we have the question of where this house is. Now, I have the circle up there. This is the historical belief of where his house was. We do read here in Mark that it appears that his house is right in Capernaum, immediately after they left. It says, as soon as they had come out of the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon and Andrew. So it seems like the house is not far from the synagogue. Although, yes?
Just keeping things in historical context, they didn't have cars.
Yes.
Everybody walked.
Yes.
So, you know, people didn't put their house way out in sticks 10 miles out of town, you know, unless that's the only place they could live. They were close by.
I showed this last week maybe, or maybe a couple weeks ago. The John 1:44 tells us that Simon and Andrew, or Peter and Andrew, are that their city is Bethsaida. I get Bethsaida and Bethesda mixed up. Anyway, Bethsaida is that is their town, and so that would be walking about an hour and a half, assuming decent roads and they can cross the Jordan okay. So it is conceivable that Jesus, James, and John, and Simon, and Andrew, that they had, once they left the synagogue in Capernaum, that they walked an hour and a half to get to Simon's house. It is conceivable. So we have the question of whether or not he lives, there his house is in Bethsaida or Capernaum. So, how do we decide that? All right, right here is, this is an old picture that I had found in Capernaum. This is called an octagonal martyrium. And it's Byzantine. Now what that means, don't get too sidetracked on the terminology, this means that this was erected in the Byzantine era, which is after the Roman Empire split at some point. And octagonal just means it's eight-sided. And martyrium is essentially a monument to show a place of significance. And so the Byzantines had a Catholic or perhaps Orthodox background. So at some point, they erected this monument here on this particular spot. So they did some excavations around there, some archaeological research, digging underneath to find out what exactly was here. And so they found that this is that there was a house underneath it. And so this is the house that they had found. It is believed to be Peter's house. And this is not a particularly ornate house, a little larger than normal, but a modest home. And understanding if Simon and Andrew lived there, and presumably Andrew's family, and definitely Peter's family lived there, then it's understandable that it'd be a little bit larger, so it could accommodate all of those people. All right.
It actually looks like it was added onto piece by piece, a lot like a lot of farm homes that you see in the countryside.
Yeah.
As families grew and more generations remained in the area.
Yeah, and that's very likely. Yeah, this is again an artist's rendering. They've cut away some of the roofs here so you can look inside a little bit. But you can see that this is
underlit.
Yes. Yes. Now they again, this is an artist rendering. And over time things get built upon something else and the walls are demolished and you just have little walls left. And so like this is just the little walls that are left. From this martyrium.
And it's several hundred years later.
Yes.
And this whole area is absolutely full of towns built on the rubble of towns built on rubbles of towns for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah.
It's not real precise.
But, so the as they look through the layers and try to determine what's underneath what and everything, they saw that this particular house had been built around, that there was some evidence a little later on that a little higher up in the dirt, that it was no longer a house, that it was something else. And so they surmised that this was turned into some kind of place of worship. And you can imagine if Peter were his house, you can imagine that it's very likely that he would allow a place of worship in his home for a while, and then his family, no doubt, were converted, and so they would want to be able to worship in this house. And maybe some people would think, oh, Peter was an apostle, this was his house, so we're going to continue this and honor him, and this is going to be the church, a church building, as it were, to worship in. And so then this martyrium was built, and now there's this. There's a Catholic church that was built on top of the martyrium. And so you see that they have built it on these stilts and whatnot so that the martyrium and the stuff underneath it are preserved. We see that this is underneath this Catholic church, that martyrium is still there. You can see the octagonal shape. And when you walk inside, they have a glass floor in the middle so you can look down upon what was once Peter's house. And in chapter 2, we'll note that that Jesus is in Capernaum, and the four men, if you recall, the four men lowering the lame man down. And so this could be the view that the four men saw as they lowered their friend down for Jesus to heal him. As some believe that Peter's house was where Jesus was. And it's very likely. And we'll get to that when we get to chapter 2. All right. This gives you some idea of the scale. You see where the synagogue is right here, and where that church built over what's believed to be Peter's house there, and how close that is to the water. So Jesus, Simon, Andrew, James, and John, they leave here, and they go to Peter's house, and Jesus heals Peter's mother-in-law. So I thought that was interesting, a little bit of archaeology and historical information about the background. I hope you found it as interesting as I did. All right. In this particular passage, we read that Jesus heals Peter's mother-in-law, and he does this. They tell her about this particular event. Simon and Andrew tell her about how sick she was at once, it says. And so, when did they typically worship?
Saturday.
On Saturday, on the Sabbath day, right? And so, they leave the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and they tell him about her at once. It's still the Sabbath day. This is a big issue that shows up later in chapter 3, how he's healing on the Sabbath day. But at this point, he is, you know, that no one is really concerned about that yet. No one in Peter's house is bothered by the fact that he's healing people on the Sabbath. And I find that interesting. Later, it's not until the Pharisees have an issue with that, that there's some friction. All right. All Jesus did was take her by the hand and lift her up, and the fever left her. What does this say about Jesus? Remember, I like to look at all these miracles and ask the question, what does this particular miracle say about Jesus?
He's a healer.
He's a healer. He heals people. So we looked at casting out the demon earlier. He has power over the spiritual realm. What power does he exhibit now with the healing of Simon's mother-in-law? Yes.
He also did it with no fanfare.
No fanfare.
Took her by the hand and lifted her up. And that was all he needed. He didn't need big stage show donations and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He didn't need all that kind of stuff. So what is this? So that's another really good point. So what does Jesus have power over here?
Life, death.
Our health, right? He has power over sickness. And that's a wonderful thing, to know that he can make sick people well. All right. His healing touch was so complete. What does she do right after? She serves them. Right after, she just had a fever. Man, can you imagine us today? We'd probably milk that for all it's worth. Maybe not. There might be some of us who would say, "Oh, I'm feeling better now. I'll serve you food now." And that's what this particular word means. This is actually the same word that's used in verse 14, I think, when the angels ministered to Jesus after he was in the wilderness for 40 days. Yes.
It also shows, if you're sick with a fever, like you said, it takes a little while to recover.
Yeah.
It shows that he didn't just help her, but he healed her.
He
didn't just feel better. She was better.
Yeah, that's right.
We would have said, "Go away. Leave me alone right now."
Now, perhaps, but at the same time, they didn't have the medicines that we do today. They had some medicines to take care of some of these things, but they didn't have the medicines that we do, and so such fevers were a little bit more dangerous back then for them. So it's possible that it could have really hurt her if it were left to continue.
All you have to do is spend some time in the third world, where they don't have all the access to the doctors and the medicines. I mean, you had some experience with that in Africa, right. And I have in Honduras and India. Fevers kill people. Dehydration brought on from fevers and diarrhea kill people.
Yeah.
You know, we don't think about it. We think, oh, you got a fever, okay, take some aspirin or take some Tylenol. Go to the ER, oh, they'll give you a bag of fluid. They didn't have IVs. You dehydrated, you died. Those things are extremely serious.
Yeah, definitely. And but Jesus had this heal her, yes.
Mark and some of the youth in another church went to, I think it was West Virginia in the hills, or Kentucky. And the church would get gifts and all at Christmas, and they'd take it up to them. Sort of a missionary. And he came back, he said, Grandma, you can't believe. And I said, oh, yeah. No water, no vacuum.
So
you just can't believe.
Yeah. All right. So this word serve implies that she attended to the needs of her guests. So what needs might they have had? They were hungry. Yeah, just as a hostess, you know, she is wanting to provide for her guests, right? And so Jesus, James, and John were her guests. And so that's you know, the idea of hospitality back then was very strong. You know, you had somebody over, you're gonna serve them. You're gonna now hopefully, and that the idea of hospitality is still a strong idea for Christians, although it might not be quite as strong as it was culturally back then. So they were willing to go above and beyond just to help whoever they had as a house guest. And so she was willing to do that. All right. So let's see. At evening. No, we didn't get to this part. Let's read verses 32 through 34, please.
At evening, when the sun had set, they brought to him all who were sick and those who were demon-possessed. And the whole city was gathered together at the door. Then he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he did not allow the demons to speak because they knew him.
All right. So this is done at evening. So at evening would be the end of the Sabbath, because they counted days from sundown to sundown, right? Not from midnight to midnight like we do. So at evening would have been considered the end of the Sabbath, at around sundown. And so when the sun had set, it says specifically, they had decided to come and say, hey, the Sabbath is over, will you heal us? They had heard about the casting out of the demon in the synagogue, as you would imagine. I don't think anybody could have kept that quiet. The potential of 1,500 people there in the synagogue, it was probably, I have no idea how many were there, but there was the potential of that many. And you could imagine that word would have gotten around town and the surrounding areas. And so they had decided to come after the Sabbath. People were more free to move about, because at that point in history, they had, you know, they often had what's called a Sabbath day's journey. They could only go for a little while without breaking the Sabbath, at least according to their traditions. And so they weren't going to break that necessarily just to come see Jesus. But after the Sabbath is over, they are more free to move about. Perhaps they even, so they heard about the casting out of the demon in the synagogue. Perhaps they even heard about the healing of Peter's mother-in-law. They see that they were perhaps desperate to be healed. If you're sick and you don't have access to a doctor, your child is sick, and you can't get them to a doctor. Some loved one is, you know, that situation. Wouldn't you be desperate for that person to be healed, that person to be taken care of? And so they were coming in droves. It says the whole city gathered together at the door of Peter's house. They were wanting to be healed. It is probable that not all 1,500 people in the town were sick. It's very likely that not everybody was sick. But do you think they were coming to see something? If you're not sick and you don't have anyone in your family that's sick, would you want to come and see what's going on?
Especially in a little fishing village where nothing happens.
Yeah.
This is the other thing. They didn't have the internet, they didn't have television, they didn't have radios. All you would know was what gossip there was in the market about anything happening. Yeah. If something, especially supernatural happened, if something supernatural happened down here in downtown Rutherford, we'd say, let's go down there, let's take a look. You know, everybody.
So it's interesting, and when I was in Africa, one of the big pieces of news, if we went to some rural areas, now there's some white guys who are coming to see us. Let's go see him, see them. So a lot of people from the town would come and check us out, see what was going on, and because they're not as third world as we might think of them. They have phones, and a lot of them have internet access. So at least this was 10 years ago, over 10 years ago when I was there. So they had that then. Imagine what they have now. But still, they had not a whole lot else going on. Yes?
I always find it interesting that in this situation with the father of 35, he also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was.
Yeah.
Many times he would say, when he heals somebody, now go and don't tell anybody what happened.
We'll definitely talk about that in a minute. So yeah, that is an interesting thought. I don't want to cut you off, but
no,
we will get to that. So people wanted to see what was going on. You reckon they were nosy, some of them?
Curious,
inquisitive. What's going on? Out of those 1,500 people, healed many people who were sick and demon-possessed. Recall that demon possession was a good deal more common at this time, as we have noted last week. We talked about that last week. Yet he still would not allow the demons to speak. So here we go. There it is. We talked about why he didn't allow them to speak a little bit last week. Do you remember why some of those reasons were?
It wasn't time.
Pardon?
It wasn't time.
So that's one aspect where he was not wanting to reveal himself too much yet. I mean, he still wanted to help people. His ministry was beginning. But he didn't want to there are a lot of people would have misconceptions about the Messiah, about taking him up as a king because of their misconceptions, as a physical king. But he didn't want that to happen just yet. We see also that he wouldn't hear the confession of a demon because there's no chance in that person being saved. Yes?
I would imagine also that he didn't want the demons to be spreading the word about him because then they could take it and twist it.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. In fact, later he says some people assume that he is casting out demons by the spirit of the demons, right? That he is doing this because he's in league with them.
That he didn't want to be connected.
Right, exactly. He didn't want to be connected in that way. That's a really good point. All right. All right, let's look at verses 35 through 39. Or do you have a comment?
One brief comment.
Sure.
Again, it's a small town. All the people everybody knows each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of y'all live in small towns now, right? Where you knew everybody. Back then, you literally knew everybody because you all walked to the same market, you saw each other on the street. You knew that your neighbor was sick. You knew somebody was demon possessed. These were not strangers that just appeared at a tent meeting and got healed and left, and nobody ever saw him again. These were everybody's family and neighbors.
Yeah.
And so there's a very intense, you can imagine what, you know, conversation was that night when everybody went home, right? And the next morning in the market, what the discussion was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they were all wanting to be healed. I do want to talk a little bit about the idea of modern faith healers in a second. Actually, right now, I will share this one thing. if a preacher comes to town and they offer some kind of healing, does the whole town come and see them? No. Why not?
You live there. It's fake.
They're charlatans, right? It's fake. Because it is. Jesus, was he fake? No, of course not. And so the whole town came to see him because he was actually healing people. It wasn't just pretending to or doing little tricks to make people think that they were being healed. These were actual healings, and they were obvious miracles that were being done. We can see later that the miracles testified to who he was as the Christ. But the modern faith healers, they don't have that ability.
I would expect too that they've also already heard the news of John Baptizer and mm-hmm. Jesus, you know, the miracle around Jesus baptism.
Perhaps a lot of them may have, yeah. So they've heard about some of these things, and they are willing to, and that's the purpose of John the Baptist, is to prepare the way. So these people, because there's something I heard about for the last census, where people will, if you send them a letter saying that the census thing will come, then they were more likely to read the census thing when it comes and fill it out. And so that initial letter is preparing the way for the actual census letter so that people will expect it, be like, oh, okay, I got this, let me fill it out and send it back. So John was preparing the way in that way, and so that they're actually expecting this even more readily than they were before. And so they decided to come out and take a look. All right, let's look at, real quick if we can, verses 35 through 39.
Now in the morning, having risen and walked long before daylight, he went out and departed to a solitary place. And there he prayed, and Simon and those who were with him searched for him. And they found him and said to him, everyone is looking for you. But he said to them, let us go into the next towns, that I may preach there also, because for this purpose I have come forth. And he was preaching in their synagogues throughout all Galilee, and casting out
All right, so after a long evening of healing people, he still wakes up early to pray. How important is prayer? Very important. And we see an example of his making the time and effort to take this chunk out of his day to pray to God, to pray to his Father. He practiced what he preached. What do we read in Matthew chapter 6, verse 6? Somebody quickly turn over there. Matthew 6:6.
But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly.
So in this sense, he was practicing what he preached. Now, it says room in that passage, but the idea is that it's a secluded place. It's not out in public where everyone can see you. And it says that he went out in the morning. I think it says before the sun.
A long time before daylight.
Yeah, so before the sun had even risen. He might have been out in the open, but nobody could have seen him because it was dark. And so he goes out to that place. Yes.
Sunrise meant literally it was sunrise. And so it's not like it's 9 o'clock when all, you know, or 8 o'clock when people get up and get moving. So he was up at 3 or 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
He also got up and left the house. Everyone was asleep because nobody knew where he was.
Right.
And then think about Jesus say 4 o'clock in the morning, long before dawn, walking through the streets of Capernaum, up into the hills somewhere to pray by himself. It's just amazing thought.
Yeah.
He didn't get very much time by himself.
That's true.
For the next 3 years.
That's right, because he was a busy man. Yeah.
That passage I just read from the New King James has italicized words, which lend a kind of a mysticism to this. I'd like to read it without the italicized words.
Okay.
Because to me it makes so much more sense. But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. That takes the mystery out of it.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
A good time to pray is when no one else is around you. Right? No one else is around to disturb you. You have a moment to yourself. And that's what Jesus sought, and that's what he got. And when we pray, we should seek a moment for ourselves. All right. I'm almost done. All right. People were looking for him, and of course they were. Perhaps there were others who needed healing. He had become popular, don't you think? All the healing that he had done, he was a popular man. Whatever the case, it was his decision to go on to other towns. Why? Why did he want to go on to other towns?
Spread the word.
Pardon? Make believers? How? By preaching, right? He says the purpose to go out of the towns to preach to other people. Miracles were his secondary purpose, and his primary purpose was to preach, right? To preach to people. And to make sure that they knew that he was the Messiah, that he was here, that he was going to take away the sins of the world, that the gospel was being fulfilled. All right. I have some other purpose statements of Jesus on my list here that we will definitely don't have time to get to, but I do want to talk about those next week. We can look at Jesus' purpose even more in depth. I want to finish out this thing, though. He did not continue healing in Capernaum at this point, but he moved on for now. Do you suppose there were still some people in Capernaum that needed to be healed? In fact, we see that later, don't we? In chapter 2, at the very beginning, he's in Capernaum when the lame man is lowered down in the house, right? So there were still people who needed to be healed, but he decided, I'm going to leave those and go to other towns. I'm not going to heal everybody in this town right away. I'm going to go other places. And that's just what Jesus does. He goes all throughout Galilee and preaches and casting out demons. He is, as one of the outlines I showed you at some point, he is destroying the devil's work by healing people and by casting out demons. All the devil has done to hurt these people, the Lord is undoing it. All right. Any comments or questions before we close? Yes. Sure.
If you've ever seen a baby born to me that was a ring, there in itself is a miracle.
Hmm. It is. How we define a miracle is something that is supernatural, something that doesn't happen every day. People who are born, that's a common everyday thing. It might not be to us. It might feel more amazing than that because we're holding a life in our hands that if you were responsible for that life, you're amazed at this little thing that's in front of you.
That's the point, though. Things can be amazing and not be miraculous.
Right.
You know, miracles in the New Testament, you stated it right, are supernatural.
Yeah.
Of amazing natural stuff. Babies
right.
being born, looking at the Grand Canyon, looking at the stars at night, it's all amazing.
Right.
But it's not supernatural, it's natural. It's
right.
what God created.
And how God made things to be... To continue, to how God had done that, but at the same time there is something almost mystical to it, in the sense that you have helped to bring a soul into this world, and you recognize, you look into the eyes of your child, and you see and you understand, you might not see, but you understand that there's a person in there, that there's a soul who will one day stand before the judgment, and it's your responsibility as a parent to make sure that they have every opportunity to stand before that judgment ready and prepared.
I guess where I was going with it is I've seen people in my career with no chance at all to live. And not beat odds, but God decided.
And there are some miraculous births in the Bible. Women who were barren, who conceived, and of course the virgin birth of Christ. So we do have some miracles concerned with conceiving. That's right.
They've given up all hope.
Yeah.
You see that person years later, nothing wrong.
Right. All right. Very good. We'll end there.